Stockholm, Paris, Berlin, Kiev, Ljubljana, Bratislava, Amsterdam,
Warsaw,
Bucharest, 2-1.
This is Network Europe, a partnership of the continent's international broadcasters. Hello, I'm Sarah Elzis, bringing you the program this month from Paris.
Slovenia has always, you know, prided itself on being one of the first in many things. They're the first of the new members to take the euro. And so, of course, they were very happy that they will be the first of the new members to preside over the EU.
You heard it. Slovenia took over the rotating presidency of the EU this week. Pride for them, a bit of trepidation in Brussels. We'll hear from our correspondent there telling us what they're worried about. And New Year's resolutions. Stop smoking, lose weight. We look at a new smoking ban in France. And we have a story from Germany, where an industry group is measuring people's sizes. And then we meet prostitutes in Amsterdam.
You know, any man is a potential customer, with all respect, of course. You have them in all sizes, all ages, all nationalities.
The city council is cleaning up the red light district. All those stories and more, plus the answer and winner of December's quiz, and a brand new quiz for the new year. Stay tuned.
En 2008, les gens se croisaient dans les airs, au volant de coléoptères, supersonique mais silencieux.
Happy New Year from Network Europe. Now, as you may know, the European Union, striving for a perfect democracy, has a rotating presidency. Every 6 months, one member state takes over, and this January 1st, it's Slovenia's turn. It's a small country just south of Austria, and it's the first from the crop of new member states to take over the post. And the pressure is on for the country to prove itself capable. This is a big year for the Union, with a range of major issues on the agenda, including Kosovo. Does the European Union support its independence from Serbia or not? Well, to help us figure this all out, who better to talk to than Radio Slovenia International's Michael Manski? He says Slovenes are very proud of taking over the presidency.
Slovenia has always, you know, prided itself on being one of the first in many things. They're the first of the new members to take the euro. When figures come out in terms of GDP and things like that, Slovenia is usually in first place as well. And so, of course, they were very happy that they will be the first of the new members to preside over the EU. It's very much a point of pride. And it's also interesting that they will be probably the last of the new members to preside over the EU, because if the Lisbon Treaty is ratified, then the whole system will change, meaning Slovenia will be the one and only new member who would be, you know, sole president of the EU.
Right. So there's excitement, but is there any trepidation? I mean, it's a big job. There are big shoes to fill. What are they talking about there?
Well, among people, among Slovenes, polls have shown that about 2 out of 3 think that it's going to be a very positive thing. And only 12% have negative expectations about the presidency. Privately, I have heard some trepidation about what this will do in terms of simple everyday things like traffic and organizing. You have to remember that Ljubljana, the capital, is a very, very small city. And when you have, you know, all these delegations from all over Europe traveling all through the capital, you know, I think a lot of people in the capital also worried about all the security and all the traffic jams that it will cause, and it will definitely be felt.
Right, right. I mean, there are logistical worries, but I imagine
yes.
There's also worries sort of on maybe with relationships with their neighbors. I guess one of the big issues Slovenia is going to have to deal with is the issue of Kosovo.
Yes, Kosovo will be the first priority that Slovenian presidency will deal with. Basically, but Slovenia has been very calm about the issue. They've said that their goal is to try to find European unity. I wouldn't expect anything very aggressive from them.
And I mean, it's a kind of a tricky situation, right? Because Slovenia is also historically had a relationship with Serbia, and now it's sort of having to dance with its different alliances.
Absolutely. It is a very complicated situation, Kosovo, and also I wouldn't forget about Croatia as well, and the Western Balkans will also be on Slovenia's plate, and there are a lot of issues between Slovenia and Croatia. There are a lot of issues still between Slovenia and Serbia, Slovenia and Kosovo. They were all formerly in Yugoslavia, and it will be tricky. On one hand, it will also be good because Slovenia knows the area well and knows the situations well that are present in the former Yugoslavia.
That was Radio Slovenia International's Michael Manski in the city of Maribor. Well, the Slovenian agenda is certainly a hectic one. They'll be looking at other Balkan states wanting to join the European Union, like Croatia and Bosnia. Then there's what to do about climate change. Some in Brussels are worried that the former Yugoslav country may have too much on its plate. RFI's Brussels correspondent Quentin Dickinson explains.
People are wondering whether a very small country will be able to take over the running for 6 months of the European Union, which is, after all, about 250 times as large as the population of Slovenia.
But, I mean, aren't small countries, don't they often take it more seriously and don't they often do better than bigger countries?
Well, that's a myth, in fact. Over the years, we've known both cases. I mean, we've had large countries with considerable success at the helm, and we've had small countries which were remarkable on their first time round and ceased to be it on their second time round. If you just take the case of the first Finnish presidency and the first Portuguese presidency, they were both remarkable. When it came round to their presidency the second time round, both were somewhat, shall we say, low-key. So there's no rule about this.
Well, are the worries about Slovenia because it's so small or also because about the issues it's going to have to tackle?
Well, both really, because Slovenia is a small country, which means also that it has a small civil service. So there's just sheer lack of manpower in Ljubljana. The other aspect, as you quite rightly point out, is that there are a limited number of issues, but which are going to be difficult. The first issue, of course, is whether or not the new constitutional treaty, the Lisbon Treaty, will be in fact ratified by all member states before the end of this year, which is the objective. And there, of course, the Slovenian presidency is unable to do very much apart from ratify in Slovenia proper. That's one aspect. The other aspect is Kosovo. Now, some people in Ljubljana are saying, well, Kosovo is part of the former Yugoslavia. We're part of the former Yugoslavia. Therefore, we know all about this far better than you do in Brussels, in Paris, in London or elsewhere. Well, this is true up to a certain extent, but there's also a danger of a too great proximity. A number of people who are in power in Ljubljana today, not least the Prime Minister Janez Janša, were in effect in politics before the end of Yugoslavia, and in many ways they probably condoned some of the decisions which were taken by the Yugoslav government in those days. So it's a very delicate question, and it is doubtful whether the Slovenian presidency will be able to do anything more, anything better than what the Portuguese presidency did during the six last months of 2007. In other words, just try to keep together the 27 member states so that although it is well known that at least four or five are totally opposed to independence of Kosovo, that at least there's some form of common position on the part of the 27.
Well, so, I mean, there's not much we can talk about now about what they're actually going to do, as we have to just wait and see. But one of the issues about, you were saying about resources, there's word that France may be taking on some of that. What's France's involvement with the Slovenian presidency?
Well, what saves a presidency on the part of a slightly weak team, which is the case of Slovenia, there's no doubt about it, is that they're working in close cooperation with the presidency before them and with the presidency which follows them. In other words, both with the Portuguese and with the French. But yes, France is attempting to help the Slovenians, not only because of this tradition, but also because the present French government, they don't want to take over a field of ruins on the 1st of July 2008.
That was RFI's Quentin Dickinson in Brussels. You're listening to Network Europe. I'm Sarah Elzis in Paris. Also on the 1st, France finally bid au revoir to the cigarette, following in the footsteps of Spain, Ireland, and Italy. The law bans smoking in bars, cafes, restaurants, and clubs. But will it work? And are the French prepared to live up to their law-defying revolutionary credentials? Will they risk a fine to hold on to one of their much-valued liberties? RFI's Hannah Lippitt went to find out.
Another day, another euro. Here in a bistro in central Paris, business continues as normal. Yet with one crucial difference. The foggy plumes of smoke that normally pollute the air are absent. A new law has forced smokers to stub out their Gauloises at the end of an era in the much-cherished café culture. Jean-Baptiste is manager here. He says he's worried about losing customers.
The problem is the smoking customer used to drink much than the other customer. We hope the difference will be not that much. The problem is for this winter, In the next summer, the people are going to smoke a cigarette and drink coffee outside in the terrace. But this winter, I don't know. Maybe we're gonna sell more drinks to take away. Maybe it's gonna be very simple, and the people are gonna accept the law.
So, will the notoriously feisty French contest the rules with the same passion transport strikers held the country to ransom just a few weeks ago? With the polls showing that 66% support the law and inspectors threatening to fine people who disobey, perhaps not.
We'll be obliged to pay 18 euros, something like this. I guess that's enough money for the people who didn't want to smoke.
Speaking to other people in the cafe, it appears rebellious spirit is here to stay.
I'm not a smoker, but I think a cafe is just for that, to smoke, to drink, and to do bad thing.
I used to smoke, and now I think it's a real problem for the smokers. It's a problem of liberty. We don't need a rule for that.
For many, the decision to ban smoking is a sensible one.
It's the best day of my life. I'm not a smoker. I've been waiting for that for such a long time. And I know a lot of French people like me, you know, waiting for that.
So this is the end of Le Cigarette, which in France has been a culture unto itself. From philosophizing in bars to looking effortlessly chic, the tradition will be ruefully missed by many. Coming on the heels of Sarkozy's vigorous social reform plans, perhaps smoke-free Parisian cafes are the latest indicator of a country forced to shed its traditional skin.
That was Radio France International's Hannah Lippitt reporting from Paris. So, was quitting smoking one of your New Year's resolutions? I've avoided making New Year's resolutions because I never seem to be able to keep them, but many of us do. And top of the list, of course, is must lose weight. But you know, we're not really keeping to it. People in industrialized nations are getting taller and fatter, but no one really knows how bodies are changing. In Germany, the last time anyone surveyed people's bodies was back in 1956. You might wonder why we need to survey our bodies at all. Well, think about clothes or getting in and out of cars or bus seats. Germans will soon know how big they really are. The Size Germany project is touring the country using high-tech 3D body scanners to measure 12,000 Germans. Deutsche Welle's Kate Hersine was one of them.
I'm standing in my underwear in the dark, with my feet apart and my arms stretched out by my sides. I feel like I'm in a science fiction movie as the bright red laser beam slowly scans down my body from head to toe. In each corner of the booth where I'm standing, four sensors move down the walls on mechanical trackers. They read the shape of the laser beam and send the digital data to a PC. I'm just one of the 12,000 people aged between 6 and 80 being scanned across the country as part of the travelling Size Germany project. It's being conducted by the Hornstein Institute, a textile research centre, for the clothing and automobile industry. For the next scan, Ingrid Zehr from the Hornstein Institute tells me to hold my left arm straight up in front of me and to make a fist while my right arm is bent at 90 degrees.
In the next position, we have a stance where we can measure the distance, for example, to machines, so we can ascertain where switches or buttons should be placed. And then the last pose is seated with bent arms. This is for the auto industry, so that we can measure the distance to the steering wheel and the other elements in the car.
According to project leader Martin Rupp from the Hornstein Institute, the 1.5 million euro study is necessary because the current size charts are out of date.
So we are doing this for 50 years. The population was measured nearly every 10 years, especially for women. For men, we have a little gap between the 70s and today. So the measurements which are used in industry and for trade are very old, especially for men.
Previous data shows that Germans are growing an average of about 1 centimetre per decade. However, the problem is that their body shapes are also changing. As work becomes more sedentary, people are becoming less muscular, and at the same time, many of them are becoming chubbier. It's the first time that the Hornstein Institute has used body scanners to collect the size data. The lasers have several advantages over the traditionally used tape measures. Not only are they more precise, they also give greater detail, such as cross-sections of arms, hips and torsos.
If you think of a trouser, for example, it's important to know the part of the cross-section which lies in the back and the part of the cross-section which is in the front of the body. So if you imagine a body with a stomach or a big stomach, more than 50% is in front of the body. This is important information for constructing a trouser, because you want to have the side seam directly on the side, so you have to know how is the circumference, and you see this only on this cross-section.
The combination of high-tech equipment, advanced software, statisticians and the clothing industry seem quite incongruous, but Martin Rupp assures me that I'm wrong.
Because in the clothing industry, the process of working and of designing is changing from 2D to 3D. Simulation of clothes, simulation in movement and so on will be done in future more and more in 3D. So the scanning process is also an important tool for the clothing industry.
The results of the study will initially only be available to the current sponsors from the clothing and auto industry, and they're big names such as Adidas, Triumph, Hugo Boss, Porsche and Volkswagen. But the Hohenstein Institute hopes to eventually make the data available to a wider range of sectors who also have a vested interest in knowing more about people's bodies.
For example, if you think on furniture, the heights of chairs, on tables, or in industry, the working areas for people who are on the manufacturing belt.
The scanners will continue to travel around Germany for another 9 months. And when the data is evaluated by the end of 2008, he is hoping manufacturers will react quickly so that shopping for clothes or getting in and out of a car becomes less of a torture for many people, including myself.
That was Deutsche Welle's Kate Hersine in southern Germany. This is Network Europe, a partnership of the continent's international broadcasters, coming to you this week from Paris. I'm Sarah Elzis. Still to come in the program, Amsterdam's red light district cleans up its act, plus the answer to last month's quiz. But first, back to those New Year's resolutions. How about watching less television? The average Pole spends 3.5 hours a day in front of the TV. Nearly half of that time is devoted to watching soap operas. Anna Piwowarska of Polish Radio's external service investigates Polish people's love for television sagas.
The signature tune to M jak Miłość or L for Love, a series that attracts almost 10 million viewers 3 times a week. Launched 8 years ago by Poland's public television, it is now also shown in the Ukraine and has its Russian counterpart. It is one of a wide range of TV series on Poland's public and commercial networks, including South American soap operas, popular sitcoms made in the US, Polish classical communist-era series, and contemporary Western-style productions, which seem to be most popular with the Polish public.
I have several favorite television series. I started watching and I got involved. It's like a drug. These actors are so beautiful and intelligent.
I have to admit that sometimes I'm really ready to miss even an important appointment just to be at home when the film starts.
Psychologist Anna Patryn says that like audiences in other countries, Poles love to identify themselves with fictional characters and their virtual lives.
Soap operas show us an idealized world of our dreams. Through the life of our favorite character, we experience situations that we would like to experience but do not have in our own lives. I don't think television sagas are harmful by definition.
On another level, TV series teach people a lot about social behavior, says sociologist Maria Rogaczewska.
People don't know the art of living because the social bonds in Poland are becoming weaker. People don't have much contact with the older generations, so they don't learn some cultural patterns our parents used to learn when they were young. So that's why people are so much interested in programs devoted to lifestyle and also soap operas. They watch the way of conversation between a wife and a husband, and they watch how to talk to children.
Still, people should be careful because sometimes television series cross the line of positive education and enter into engineering the social perception of controversial issues.
Maybe it's too much to say that they are manipulating, but still they are extremely influential. They really have the impact on human minds and on the way people are behaving in daily interactions with each other.
Public opinion surveys in Poland show that some people are reluctant to admit that they ever watch television series, as according to many, they are of no value at all. This is perhaps going too far. One must just make sure that they don't become an addiction.
M jak miłość, wiele imion ma. M jak miłość.
That was from Anna Piwowarska of Polish Radio's External Service.
This sword is a blessed sword. It has to serve God's a good cause.
That's a clip from Arn, the most expensive Swedish film ever. It opened on Christmas Day and it pulled in over 160,000 spectators in the first 2 days. But can all those moviegoers be wrong? Radio Sweden's Jasna Karlin met one critic who doesn't think this knight in shining armor will win the box office battle.
One of the most successful Swedish writers, Jan Guillou, wrote a best-selling trilogy about a Templar knight Arn, his childhood, his knighthood, and his love to a maiden Cecilia. And now the book has become a film with the whole spectre of visual delights that history would offer. The passion of religion, great battles of the Holy War, maidens in nunneries, and widely exotic landscapes of Arn's native West Gothia.
Under the name of Andergothia, you will journey to the Holy Land.
You will be a Knight Templar.
Roger Wilson, a film critic from the culture department at the Swedish Radio, was not impressed.
What's most disappointing is actually sort of the script. They've gone for epic but not emotional. They've succeeded in costumes and hairdos, so that the whole atmosphere. But the story sort of leaves me cold. It takes 40 minutes until the first sword fight. And I mean, sword fights is what a movie like this is all about.
The film companies now hope for at least 1 million sold tickets to recover some of the cost, which is a sensation in itself.
This is absolutely going to have a lot of people going to the cinemas. 1 million people? I don't know. That hasn't happened in a long time in Sweden, not for a Swedish movie. I think that would be remarkable.
I am glad that God has given me this chance to get to know my enemy.
You respect him?
You must know your enemy to defeat him.
I'd say that Arn, compared to new movies, is a bit old-fashioned. It's a slow-moving. It doesn't have great special effects. And even though it's a high-budget movie in Sweden, you can sort of see that, well, how many sword fights and how many sort of big battles can we have in one movie for this amount of money?
But what about those beautiful landscapes that West Gothia, where now everybody hopes that there'll be streams of tourists traveling to trace Arn and his historical steps?
Mm. That will, of course, happen for the Swedish audience. I wouldn't be surprised if it actually manages to do some money in Germany, where Sweden in itself is a huge brand. But I'm sorry to say, I don't think this will be the success that the movie company hopes for, not nationally and not globally.
What kind of man is he, our enemy? He's like us, a man of his word.
That report from Radio Sweden's Jasna Karlin. This time of year, most of Europe is cold and gray. Time for a weekend break, right? Well, many will head to the Dutch capital, and a top attraction there is the famous Red Light District. But the district may not be around much longer. The city council has announced plans to clean up Amsterdam's image, and a third of the window brothels are to be closed. Instead of prostitutes, windows will display the wares of upmarket shops. Sex workers fear they'll be driven into the streets, and some say Amsterdam's reputation as a liberal and tolerant city is being threatened. Radio Netherlands Worldwide's Paul Anstis reports.
It's Saturday evening in Amsterdam, and weekend revelers from around the world venture into the seductive cobbled streets and narrow alleyways of the Rosseboort, better known as the city's Red Light District. In the heart of the area, the bells of the 14th century Ouderkerk or Old Church ring out like sirens in the night.
I'm standing just opposite the Old Kirk,
surrounded by ladies of the night.
The fact that these things exist side by side is a tribute to Dutch tolerance. But all that's now under threat. One third of the red light district's window brothels are being forced to close as part of a clean-up operation by Amsterdam's mayor. Job Cohen believes that prostitution has encouraged the growth of organized crime, drugs, and the slave trade. But former prostitute Mariska Major believes there's another reason.
I think the people that are creating politics are people that simply hate prostitution and hate the red light district. That's why they want to close it. People talk about forced prostitution and they want to save all the poor women. The real pimps, the real problems are happening on the street. And if you want to do something about that, I think it's even more important to keep all these working places open so you can stay in touch with the women.
One of the narrow streets in the red light district is Trumpet Alley. It's about a meter wide. On either side of the alley are windows lit up by red lights. The sex workers stand provocatively at the doorways.
You know, any man is a potential customer, with all respect, of course. You have them in all sizes, all ages, all nationalities. A typical thing for window prostitution is that it's a very independent way of working. You pay rent for a little room, you make your own prices and your own decisions for everything.
Although some people feel a little uncomfortable with such an open display, others, particularly tourists, say Amsterdam would just not be the same without it.
It'd be a little bit like taking William Shakespeare out of England.
You look at all the other countries, it's just going to drive it underground, you know, so people will probably still come, and if there's demand, it'll be there, you know, so I suppose you're just going to criminalize it, you know, you're going to make it worse, really, you know, out in the open here.
Today's a bit odd, isn't it, really? It's like window shopping, it's very strange.
Mariska Major reminisces about the place that's been her home since she was 16.
You know, sometimes I really hate the red light district. When I don't hate it, I feel very much at home here. I still like and enjoy it to stand behind the windows in the red lights.
That report from Paul Anstis of Radio Netherlands Worldwide. This brings us almost to the end of this week's program. I have two more things for you, though. The answer and winner of December's quiz, plus a brand new quiz question for January. You were asked last month to name the famous botanist whose birth was being celebrated in Sweden. Well, the answer was Carl Linnaeus. The winner for December is Salman Khan from Hyderabad in India. Salman, you'll get some goodies from Radio Sweden in the mail soon. Jealous? Well, you can participate in this month's quiz. I'd like you to guess another personality. This one's a Frenchman whose birth 100 years ago is being celebrated this year in 2008. The music is a hint because he's a composer and he was a very religious man.
The Catholic faith. For him, it was the most important. Many pieces have a relation in the title with the religion. For him, it was the reason for him to create it.
I'll be giving you a new hint each week this month. If you think you know who he is, send your answers to contact@networkeurope.org. Remember to include your full name and where you listen to the program. Again, that's contact@networkeurope.org.
Regardez-moi.
And that's the end of Network Europe for this week. Make sure to visit us online at networkeurope.org to send us your comments. I'm Sarah Elzis, and from all of us here, Happy New Year. The music I'm leaving you with is sung by Carla Bruni. For those of you following the French news, Miss Bruni is our president's new girlfriend. Enjoy.
Les femmes, elles me frôlent de là, regard penché, bien malgré moi, ouais. Je suis le plus beau du quartier. Est-ce mon visage, ma peau si finement grainée, mon air suave, est-ce mon allure? Est-ce la grâce anglo-saxonne de ma cambrure? Est-ce mon sourire? Ou bien l'élégance distinguée de mes cachemires? Quoi qu'il en soit, c'est moi le plus beau du quartier. Mais prenez garde à ma beauté, à mon exquise ambiguïté. Je suis le roi du désirable, je suis l'un des habillables. observez-moi. Observez-moi de haut en bas, vous n'en verrez pas de comme ça. Je suis le favori, le bel ami de toutes ces dames et de leur mari. Regardez-moi. Je suis le préféré, une belle victime voudrait se pendre à mes lacets. Ça les abîme. Les beaux messieurs, eux, voudraient tellement me déshabiller. Ça les obstine. Bien malgré moi et bien après moi, je suis le plus beau du quartier. Mais prenez garde à ma beauté, à mon exquise ambiguïté. Je suis le roi du désirable, je suis l'un des habillables. Observez-moi. Observez-moi de haut en bas, vous n'en verrez pas de comme ça. Je suis le favori, le petit chéri de toutes ces dames, leur mari aussi.